Welcome back to Beyond the Uniform. I'm Justin Asiri, and each week I interview military veterans about their civilian career. Today's episode number 48 with Kate Kranz.
Veterans, writ large, miss being in the military because of that sense of community and of a greater purpose. So I think in that sense, politics is a perfect fit for veterans. I mean, you work hard with a group of people to solve problems and make a difference and serve your country. I mean, that, you know, the mission statements are perfectly aligned. The thing that I think gets hard for a lot of veterans getting into the political space is in order to get elected, there has to be a lot of sort of self-aggrandizement. You have to be able to go out and tell a community of people why you're so great and why they should vote for you. Whereas veterans, I think, as a group, are a little more reserved about that.
The top two reasons to listen to today's episode are, one, public service. Many veterans I interview talk about how they miss the sense of purpose that they found in the military. Kate is an example of a veteran who has continued that aspect of service in her civilian career. She talks about her work helping prepare other veterans for a career in public and political service. Two, unexpected transition. Kate talks about her unexpected transition from the military and advice for others who have the desire to serve longer term but may face their transition to civilian life sooner than they'd originally planned. As always, at beyondtheuniform.io, you'll find other great episodes and resources. You'll also find the show notes for this episode, which provides links to websites we discuss on the show, as well as timestamps for each topic we cover. So let's dive in to my interview with Kate Kranz. Well, joining me today, usually in Boston, but today in Baltimore, is Kate Kranz. Kate, thank you so much for joining me.
Hi, Justin. It is a pleasure to be with you, virtually.
So a quick background on Kate. Kate's the director of women's initiatives at Veteran Campaign, a nonpartisan, nonprofit organization whose mission is to encourage, mentor, and prepare veterans, transitioning service members, and other members of the military community for a second service in civic and political leadership. She started out at the Naval Academy as my classmate, the class of 2002, and served as a naval flight officer for 11 years. And she's in the process of finishing up a Master's of Law and Diplomacy from Tufts University, and also holds a Master's of Administrative Leadership from Oklahoma University. So Kate, to kick things off, maybe for a veteran listening who may not be familiar with the Veterans Campaign, how would you explain what you guys do?
So Veterans Campaign is focused on, as you said, inspiring, mentoring, and training veterans to run for political office, to take their place in what we call a career of second service. Anyone who has served in the military has a real sense of what it means to serve their country. And I think that those are the types of people that we really need serving in Congress today. And not just in Congress, but all the way down into like very small but just as important community level leadership positions. So we need people who have shown their dedication to service on school boards, on county commissions, all the way up to Congress. And some of our most successful, even presidents and vice presidents, have been military veterans. So, because they really know what it means to be commander in chief. So that's what we're really trying to inspire in veterans, is that continued commitment to service.
And how does it work if, let's say, someone's listening and they want to pursue active engagement in politics or in civil service? What does that process look like? They reach out to you guys, and then in what way do you guys specifically help them?
So politics can be a really difficult career field to get into. There aren't a ton of entry points. At the grassroots level, there are certainly ways to get civically involved. What Veterans Campaign does, really our baseline service that we offer, is workshops. So the most basic workshop that we offer is for 2 days over the course of a weekend, and we partner with campaigning and fundraising experts, mostly in the DC area, to come and explain to somebody who has no idea even how to start running for office, how that process works. And there are certainly other organizations that offer that type of training, but what we really do is offer the why veterans are different aspect of it, and explaining how veterans can, you know, leverage their service appropriately and correctly in order to make that an asset for a campaign instead of a liability.
That's great. I mean, I'm just thinking of other things that have come up on the show before is the service to school, which helps a veteran by connecting with them with another veteran to help them go through the application process for undergrad or grad school. Or there's like American Corporate Partners, where if I want to get into sales, they'll put me in contact with another veteran in sales at a Fortune 500 company. And it makes sense that if a veteran also wants to get into politics, that they need that help in the same way that we need help getting into schools and getting into a corporate environment of just walking someone through. Like I would have no idea how to even start if I was interested in going that direction. So it's great that there's an organization specifically set up for that. And in terms of your job, what does your day-to-day life look like as you serve as the director of Women's Initiatives?
So this program really, it's interesting. Veterans Campaign was actually, do you know the background of it? It was actually started, okay, Veterans Campaign was started by a Naval Academy classmate of ours.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Seth Lynn, do you remember Seth Lynn from?
Yeah.
Okay, so Seth founded Veterans Campaign in 2009. He was in the Marine Corps and then was at the Woodrow Wilson School of Public Policy, I think, at Princeton. And he saw some advertisements for campaigning workshops for women at the Center for Women in Politics, CAWP, at Rutgers University. And he was literally, the way he tells the story is like, and I thought to myself, wow, that's great that they have those programs to help women run for office. I wonder if there's anything out there to help veterans.
Oh, no way.
I had been doing some research on the decline of veterans in Congress. Post-World War II, there were 70% of Congress had served in the military, and now we're at under 20%. Like, so 535 members of Congress and only, 100, give or take, have ever served in the military or know what that means, truly. So Seth went to one of these campaign training workshops for women and got the idea to launch Veterans Campaign, which he did back in 2009. And just in the last couple of years, back in, I guess it was 2015, they were partnered with another organization who gave them funding to do this week of programming. And at the end of it, they did a Women Veterans Day. So they gathered, it was like 30 women veterans to sort of talk about the issues that are very specific to women in politics and what that means for a woman veteran. And then last summer, I was kind of, I don't know, I was just talking to Seth and asking, you know, how things are going and what's going on. And he said, I really need somebody to help build out this women's program. So this is really just a year in the making. I had the opportunity to take the program, the Veterans Campaign Women's Initiative, through a nonprofit incubator that the Atlantic Council puts on through their Millennium Leadership Program, and was able to do about 10 days of development for the program. At the end, we competed for a grant. And then this summer, I was able to launch our very first Women Veterans Symposium. So that involved getting a group of women together with the very generous support of the Atlantic Council, who let us use their very cool boardroom on the 12th floor overlooking the city. We partnered with an organization called Homefront Rising, which encourages and helps military spouses to run for office. And obviously with the demographics, a large proportion of military spouses are women. So we got together with them and held this symposium, brought in experts on, you know, a whole variety of issues that are important to discuss when you're talking about women in politics, and the way that military spouses and military veterans can sort of lead the way into political parity in Congress.
That's great. Yeah. You know, what strikes me when you say that is that one of the common themes that comes up when I talk to other veterans on the show is that they miss that service. Like, they really miss that feeling of purpose and of making a difference and actively contributing to the country when they were on active duty. And it seems like if someone has a thick enough skin to go into it, that politics or civil service of some capacity is a great way to scratch that itch, to still contribute, to be making a difference, to being active in bettering the lives of a lot of people. And I imagine that veterans are very well qualified for that sort of work.
I agree.
Well, actually, let me ask you this. And I'm just wondering, you know, based on your experience so far, in what ways do you think veterans would really enjoy, like, going into politics? And in what ways do you think that they, what would be, like, the hard part for veterans?
Well, like you said, veterans writ large miss being in the military because of that sense of community and of a greater purpose. So I think in that sense, politics is a perfect fit for veterans. I mean, you work hard with a group of people to solve problems and make a difference and serve your country. I mean, that, you know, the mission statements are perfectly aligned. The thing that I think gets hard for a lot of veterans getting into the political space is in order to get elected, there has to be a lot of sort of self-aggrandizement. You have to be able to go out and tell a community of people why you're so great and why they should vote for you. Whereas veterans, I think, as a group are, you know, a little more reserved about that. You know, veterans aren't taught to put their service at the forefront of what they do. You know, they're taught to put service before self. But in politics, unfortunately, initially, it really has to be self out front. Because if you don't promote yourself, nobody's going to know who you are and nobody's going to vote for you. So it kind of takes getting over that hump in order to get into Congress to really be able to serve the way you remember service being. And I would imagine, obviously, I've never served in Congress, but, you know, it's a 2-year election cycle. And what we hear from a lot of people is, you know, it's just sort of nonstop campaigning and nonstop fundraising. And it is hard to look somebody in the face and say, will you give me money? It's a lot easier to say, we're doing this for something else. You know, I believe in something else and I'm supporting this, but it's a lot harder to say, will you support me so I can support you?
Yeah. It's funny because, yeah, and that comes up repeatedly is how difficult most veterans find networking, because it does require you to networking and even interviewing, it requires you to be boastful, which is not common, I think, in our military background. And what you just described, it does seem like that would be such a major component of learning to be comfortable promoting yourself, asking for direct support, telling people about your accomplishments. And I could see why that would be very, very difficult. And at the same time, I just feel like with that background in integrity and background in, like, serving for the greater good and personal sacrifice, I could see how tremendous of an asset that would be. Well, let's maybe back up to when you were on active duty. At what point did you know you were going to leave the military, and how did you approach that decision?
So this is kind of an interesting part of my narrative, and it's only looking back with a lot of self-reflection do I really understand, you know, how this all worked. So as you mentioned, I was a naval flight officer, and I went through flight school and served with an E-2C Hawkeye squadron flying off the USS Ronald Reagan. And I did 3, really kind of 2.5 deployments with them. One of them was like a short 4-month surge deployment. And in the middle of that that set of orders, the Navy was in an interesting paradigm. Was the time when people were getting ripped out of commands to go on IAs because, like, their number was up. You remember that?
Yeah. Yep.
They eventually kind of made it so that people could take those IAs and those, you know, wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, those support missions, and do them as written sets of orders. But initially, they were just you know, pulling people out of jobs that they were already doing. So our squadron got tapped to send somebody, and, you know, through, I'm can't imagine what it was like for the skipper to try to, like, you know, it's Sophie's choice, like picking one of your kids to send away. It turned out that I had, like, just enough qualifications, but not too much, at exactly 2 years in the command that it was me. I kind of, you know, was voluntold slash volunteered to go. And that really kind of screwed up my, my FITREP cycle. I ended up, whereas the goal coming out of your operational tour as an aviator, you want to be the number one EP. Should I be talking about this in civilian terms?
Yeah, or? No. I think anyone listening is, would understand that. Yeah.
You want to score as high as you can on your FITREPs, but during this, and it just, you know, the way that the cycles work and the way you compete with the other people, what the squadron CO ultimately decided to do with me, since I was gone for 7 months, that I ended up with a non-observed FITREP with a, you know, very nice letter attached to it, explaining the sacrifice that I had made and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, at the end of that, you know, you kind of know that that's a little bit of a blow. And leaving the squadron, I made the decision not to go, as aviators call it, into production. I didn't really want to go back and teach at the RAG. I didn't want to go to a test squadron. Some aviators need to fly. It's in their blood. I loved being part of the naval aviation community, but I knew that my best assets and my best skills were not in the aircraft, that they were kind of in other places. Unfortunately, the Navy kind of wants you marching down one path, and they kind of frown upon variances to the path. And while going back and being on the staff at the Naval Academy is not that big of a shift, the next thing I asked them to go do was to go to Afghanistan. For a year. So another job out of the aircraft. And then at that point I was at a critical career juncture where I was waiting to make 04, and a bunch of the people in our class had gotten pushed back a year. So it was like some unusual swap time, prior to making lieutenant commander and then making department head. I chose to go, take a job over on the 4-star staff in Italy, in Naples. Initially I was brought over there to be the protocol officer, but eventually I ended up being the admiral's aide. Fantastic job. I wouldn't change anything about what my career was like. Afghanistan was one of the most incredible experiences of my life. It changed who I am, and it got me to where I am today. Same thing with the orders over in Italy, but this is an incredibly long way to tell you that ultimately I was not selected to promote to 04. And all of the things that I explained to you were all of the reasons why. So it was not a shock to anybody when that didn't happen. And I could have done something to change that, but I chose not to, because I kind of knew that there was a life outside of the Navy where I felt like I could thrive. So on paper, the Navy really made the decision for me, but I kind of knew it was kind of like, you know, you kind of know somebody's about to break up with you and you just let them do it.
Yeah. Well, what sticks out with me about this is there's you know, a handful of people I've spoken with where there's some sort of unexpected medical problem that then they're forced to transition out, or there's people who have life circumstances that force them to you know, they choose to leave the military. And I think your story is a perfect example too, where you can have your plans, you can have your strategy, and then there's things completely out of your control that completely change that trajectory. And I think it's just a good reminder that, you know, anyone on active duty, you never know if things are going to work out the way that you want, and that you always need to be thinking of what that potential next step is in a different career. And so I'm wondering, when you did separate, then how did you figure out what you wanted to do? How did you figure out what you wanted to do next?
Well, you know, once I saw the writing on the wall, and I really started seeing it when I was in Afghanistan. So I kind of knew I was taking this tour in Italy as sort of like a twilight tour. So I knew it was coming, but I knew I still wanted to serve. Honestly, when I initially got to Italy, I was studying for the LSATs, because the work that I had done in Afghanistan with the Rule of Law Field Force really kind of inspired me to look into a legal profession. Like, I kind of liked, I worked with a lot of lawyers. In fact, my boss in that job is now the Navy JAG. So being exposed to a lot of that, I kind of started realizing, hey, I like the way these people think, you know, I kind of get it. I got a lot of counseling and mentoring from Admiral Crawford, the JAG, that, you know, don't go at your, and this wasn't certainly meant to be ageist in any way, but he was kind of like, hey, at your age, and I was 33, 34 at the time. He said, if you don't want, he said, this is a 4-year commitment. It's going to law school, taking the bar, and then becoming a junior associate at a firm. Is that what you want to do? And I said, well, no, but I mean, no, you know, it was amazing how quickly that answer came. Well, no, I don't want to practice in a law firm. As much as I love the show Suits, you know, I don't really think that's the life I want for myself. So I ended up kind of just looking around at, you know, I was like, well, there's all these great schools out there. I talked to some friends from our class who had been very successful, they've been successful getting admitted to the Harvard Kennedy School. I kind of looked at that and I said, you know, it's such a fantastic program and that would be an honor to get accepted to. What I'm really interested in is foreign policy. I'd been, you know, the Afghanistan tour was with a NATO command. The command I worked for in Italy, that 4-star command, was also a NATO command. So I was kind of obsessed with NATO at the time. And I was like, you know what? I think I really want to go to a foreign policy school. Simultaneous to that, my boss was the 4-star stationed at the Joint Forces Command, the NATO command component in Italy. He was also dual-hatted as the commander of Naval Forces Europe. So his direct boss in NATO was Admiral Stavridis at the time. And I remember sitting with one of my colleagues planning the Admiral's trip up to Brussels for Admiral Stavridis' retirement and change of command. And someone in the office said, hey, what is Stavridis going to do after he leaves the military? I mean, like, this guy has been like the supreme allied commander of NATO. What is next for that guy? And we looked it up and it was like, he's going to go be the dean at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. And literally everyone in the office is like on Google, like, what the hell is the Fletcher School? Two of us in the office ended up going to the Fletcher School. And I've told Admiral Stavridis that story and he, you know, he meets people and it sounds like, you know, you talk to the guy and it's like, I'm not trying to kiss your ass, but I'm totally here because of you. Like, you are the reason I Googled the Fletcher School. And he laughs at that story because, you know, he remembers, you know, the gang down in Naples. So, yeah, it's, anyway, does that answer your question?
Yeah, no, totally. And it's interesting because, how you ended up at Tufts and how you ended up at the Veterans Campaign is kind of fortuitous that you had that personal connection and it was this unexpected thing and it's kind of unplanned. And I think that's also, it seems to be a common trend is just the role that those relationships can play in how we choose what to do. And you know, I just think of you as such an incredibly natural and gifted networker and, your ability to kind of make and forge quick connections. So it's no surprise to me knowing you that, you know, the people that you've met and interacted with over the last 20 years have, you know, continued to play a role in having you discover unexpected and unknown opportunities.
That's so true. That's why we maintain Christmas card lists, isn't it?
Yeah, no, that's true. What about, as you look back on that transition to civilian life, what was something that was surprising for you or that you didn't know to expect about the move from active duty to being a civilian?
That's a great question. You know, my transition was kind of unique in that during my last tour of duty in Naples, I met my husband, and we were both lieutenants there at the time. It was interesting when we met, we both kind of knew where we were going. And we were both leaving Naples at the same time. It just turned out. We were both supposed to leave in December of 2013. He already knew he was going to Monterey and had accepted the Navy's bonus to go be a department head. He didn't know where, but we knew his next two stops were going to be Monterey and then Newport. I hadn't actually applied to Fletcher yet, but it was on the radar when I met him. So it's funny to say that, you know, it worked out. Like, I definitely took a couple of schools off the list. I was looking at applying to Columbia Law and to the foreign policy program at Columbia, but, you know, it worked out that I wanted to go to Fletcher anyway. That was my number one choice. So I was like, screw it. I'm not going to apply anywhere else. Because even if I get into Columbia, I'm not going to go to New York. Like, that's going to be a pain. You know, once Jamie and I kind of decided that we were going to go for it and get engaged, it was like, well, this will actually work out. Me in Boston, him in Newport, you know, we kind of looked at the way the timing would work, and it worked out brilliantly. So to answer your question about what was unexpected about getting out of the military, you know, I was able to stay connected with people. You know, social media is so brilliant in that way. There is sort of a sadness at, you know, hanging up your uniform. Like, when you actually, and I made the decision to kind of like go, like, quit cold turkey and go into the IRR. So, like, you know, getting out of the military to the point where I folded up my uniforms and put them in a box to never pull them out again. I mean, I have an IRR ID card, which, you know, kind of keeps you on by like a little bit of a thread, makes you feel involved. But the most interesting thing I've found about being a civilian is that there really is a civil military divide. I had about 6 months before I started at the Fletcher School when Jamie was in Monterey and I was bored. So I studied for and passed my level one sommelier exam and got a job at a wine bar.
That's awesome.
It was fascinating. People love to chat with people behind wine bars. I mean, I'm sure that's probably all bartenders, particularly in this place where, like, it was a slower pace of, you know, tasting, and part of, you know, the kind of the wine bar environment is, you know, I'm teaching you about what I'm pouring you and we're having a dialogue about it. And so ultimately the dialogue gets into kind of a personal realm, and, you know, people would always ask, oh, what do you do? How long have you lived in Monterey, if they're tourists or whatever? And it was always fascinating. I mean, people were always shocked to find out that I had been a naval aviator for 12 years and wanted to know what that was like. They wanted to know what Afghanistan was like and what it was like flying off an aircraft carrier. And it was funny. I was supposed to be a wine ambassador, but I almost felt like I was a civil divide ambassador standing behind that wine bar. I always wear a necklace with my wings on it. And some people who are in the military would notice that. And I always made sure I was wearing my Naval Academy ring, because those are kind of conversation starters. So people that know would recognize it and be like, are those your husband's wings or is that your husband's ring? You know, which, you know, the sexism of that aside, it was always a good conversation starter. But it did fascinate me that even in a military community like Monterey, I mean, Monterey is a small military community. You know, there's not that many military people running around there, but and it's certainly not an operational community. But it fascinated me how little the civilian population truly knows about what has been going on for the last 15 years and what people in the military do, and that they're normal people.
Oh man. I mean, it's less than 1% of people end up serving in the military. It's such a small, it is one of those things where it's always surprising when people find out that you're in the military, the types of questions they ask. And some of them are just so, like, shocking, you know? And yeah. It's, you just realize like how little people understand about the military in general.
Yeah, it's, Hollywood plays a big role in that. You know, it's
yep.
for the like. Okay, I mean, if we really drill down into it, I'm sure we can find some stuff. But like, it wasn't that.
Yeah. What about if someone's listening and they're thinking of getting out in the next couple of years? Any advice on things they could be doing now to help prepare them for that transition?
You know, it always kind of seemed like going to school or going to grad school was kind of kicking the can down the road. You know, like, oh, I don't have to grow up yet. I'll just go to grad school. But to be frank, I think graduate school is an incredible opportunity. And especially with the post 9/11 GI Bill offering, you know, support financially for that endeavor, most of these big, you know, business schools and foreign policy schools, you know, have career offices. And there are so many people, I mean, there's Student Veterans of America, there's all these organizations out there that are trying to help veterans get tapped into these networks so that they can continue to serve. I mean, even if you're in the private sector in, you know, a for-profit company, there's still an element to service in all of that. So I think anyone who's considering getting out, the two like biggest pieces of advice that I would give them is even as far as 2 years out, you know, or a year, you know, realize that you're becoming a veteran and start educating yourself on what the services are that the VA provides. You know, get smart on what your, disability benefits are. Get smart on some of the vocation training that they have, on the education services that they have, all those kind of things. And, you know, understand what's out there for you and look at fellowships and grad school programs and so many of these different organizations, like the ones that you were mentioning at the beginning of the interview. There's all kinds of stuff out there. There's Vets for Diplomacy. There's Veterans Campaign. There's Hill Vets, another organization that's, you know, kind of trying to build a community of veterans that are just, you know, working on the Hill, maybe not in elected office. There's another one called Vet Tech Trek that like a guy from the class of 06 started trying to get vets in the tech industry. There are people out there that are trying to help, so tap into those networks and, early.
And for people listening, I'll put links to all of the places that Kate's mentioning in the show notes, so you can click there if you're interested in those, because those are great resources. I always like to kind of end with something more open-ended, Kate, and that's, you know, just knowing that you've got a community of active duty and recently transitioned veterans listening. Anything we didn't cover that you'd want to share with them? It could be about personal life, professional life, anything at all, but anything you'd want to pass on to them or share with them?
The one thing that really stands out for me, and it still blows my mind that we entered service in 1998, like during the first Clinton administration, is that, you know, the community is still there. The military is certainly a community, and the military does a great job of community building, but that the veterans community is still out there. Veterans work well together. And there's a shared common experience among veterans that I think is really valuable, but it is also really valuable to take our service and sort of be an ambassador out into the world and to bridge that civil divide.
No, I love that too, because it's, like you said, there are so few people that have exposure to the military and to a veteran. And it's interesting because it's like, there's like the two parts that what you're saying is like, one, like be that positive example, but two, realize that other veterans want to help, you know, veterans as well. And so realizing that there's so many resources that are available as a veteran and being able to connect with those people who have had that shared experience.
Well, I guess the other point that I want to make is it is really hard to hang up a uniform. It is really hard because it's an identity. You know, it's not just the job you do, it's who you are. It's a rank that you hold. It's a title at the beginning of your name. It's the outfit you put on your back every day. So that is something that's really hard to give up. But the thing that I would want to impart to anyone who's, you know, looking at making the choice to get out, or, you know, looking at the military deciding that for them, or, you know, looking at a retirement where it's just, you know, this is the end of the road, that there is a world out there, that there are so many opportunities and there are still ways to serve. There are still ways to be a veteran who's focused on making the world a better place without wearing a uniform. There are other uniforms you can put on.
That's great. I mean, it also seems like that's what you've effectively done, is you found a way to continue to be connected to the veteran community and a way to continue to provide value through your work at the Veterans Campaign. And that's a good reminder that that it is a big loss when you transfer from active duty, and there's ways to try to still serve and provide value.
Definitely.
Well, thank you very much. Kate is at Veterans Campaign. You can check her out there. And thanks so much for your time on this.
Of course. Good talking to you.
Surface.
Thanks for listening. Before you go, three important announcements. First, if you believe in what I'm doing and believe in supporting veterans in their careers, please, please, please help me spread the word. The best way I know to do that right now is by taking 18 seconds to write a review on iTunes. It would mean a lot. Second, based on my interviews, I'd advise any and all veterans to look at servicetoschool.org and the American Corporate Partners. Both are completely free for veterans and give you a lot of great resources for your education or professional life, respectively. Third, there are a ton of other great interviews, resources, and data at beyondtheuniform.io. Check it out, share it with your friends, and drop me a line if you have any feedback, because I'd love to hear from you. Thanks, and see you on the next interview.